Good morning, and welcome to the Publishing Business Virtual Conference and Expo. I'm Brian Howard, editor-in-chief of Book Business Magazine and part of the team that's putting on this shindig this morning. I hope you enjoyed Rory O'Connor's opening keynote discussion, Can Publishing Really Be Replaced by a Button? It's my pleasure to welcome you to Cross-Platform Production Demystified, the first book track live session of the 2012 Publishing Business Virtual Conference and Expo. Now, before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the hour, and you can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets on this console. To figure out what all of those widgets do, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn how you can customize your experience today. You can even tweet right from the console, and we encourage you to do so with the hashtag PBV12. Lastly, if you leave this session at any time or would like to view it again later, you can access the entire presentation from the auditorium in the Publishing Business Virtual on-demand environment, which will be open for 3 months beginning on Monday, September 17th, 2012. All right, so let's get to our session. First, I'd like to introduce our esteemed panel. This morning, we welcome John Shaw. John is the Executive Director of Publishing Technologies at Sage Publications. A less known fact is that John is also the co-proprietor of Simi Valley's Almasol Winery. Joining John is Andrew Brenneman, the founder of Finitive and the author of Book Business Magazine's popular Digital Directions column. And rounding out the panel is Brian O'Leary, principal at Magellan Media Consulting and the co-editor of Book, A Futurist's Manifesto, which is available now from O'Reilly. We'll be starting off today with John, who will speak about the challenges Sage has confronted in transitioning from a print-first production process to an XML-first or format-agnostic process. Andrew will take the baton and discuss a third approach, the use of cloud delivery services, and Brian O'Leary will discuss the strategic implications of workflow migration. And we'll leave lots of time for Q&A from the audience. So without further ado, let me welcome John Shaw.
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate it. Good morning, everyone. It's very early out here on the West Coast, so anybody who's on the West Coast, thank you for joining us. As Brian mentioned, I'm John Shaw, the Executive Director of Publishing Technologies at Sage Publications. And what that means is that I oversee a department that handles all of our content platforms, content management systems, and content conversion. In the past here at Sage, I've been in the production department and managed and oversaw typesetting, the actual production process itself, peer review systems, and other such editorial and production systems. So a little about Sage, quickly. Let's see if I can switch these slides. A little about Sage Publications, which I think is good for us just to see and understand before we go in, so you have the context of my background and Sage's background. So we've been around since 1965, and we're privately held. We have about 1,300 employees, and probably most importantly, down the bottom right hand of that slide, is that we publish both journals and books, and of course books could be referenced, it could be textbooks, it can be all types of different books, and increasingly more so online products. So not books, not journals, content. And with that, moving on here, I think as all of us have seen over time, increasingly more so on a daily basis, is that the publishing process has become increasingly more complex. And if you've been around for years, you know that it used to be fairly easy. You would typeset your book, you would typeset your journal, and you would print it, and it would be done, and you'd go to the next issue, or you'd go to the next book, and it would be done, and it was a very simple process. But increasingly more so, that's become more complex over the years. The presence of online platforms and distribution channels have made that a little more challenging, and nothing is ever just finished anymore. And so with that, we've had to mature the process. And what we're seeing on this slide here is really a very simplistic view of what life looks like, and if only it were this simplistic. So on the left, I have some simple basic diagrams, journals, books, reference. It's really not that easy, but just to simplify it. And on the other side, we see things like Sage journals or Sage research methods or Sage knowledge, book platforms that we have, And others could be just other platforms, other aggregators that we may send content to. But as time goes on, we get more complex with this. And as we see, we have, again, a lot of content, and we have a lot of places for it to go, and we need to do more with the content. And so it's not as simple as just getting the content into the right formats, you know, print and online. Now it's about how can we enrich the content, and where else do we need to send the content, and what format does the content need to be in, and what variation of that format does the content need to be in. So we inherently just have some challenges here. Life is not so simple. Now, I'll jump into this slide, but then I'm going to kind of go back and forward, so hopefully you can work with me here. What I've tried to display here is that to get through a lot of the challenges that we have, that we had to adopt some basic practices. So as most of you probably know, you are doing right now, you create your typeset or typeset your books or journals or the content that you're working on, and maybe it doesn't always have to be typeset, but then you quickly have to get it into another format, and typically that would be an XML format. And then that would be distributed out to the different platforms or aggregators or whatever you use to publish that online with. And to do that, and you probably have multiple different formats that you need it to go in. So what we have here and what we have tried to do over the last few years on both our journal side and our book side is to create some basic processes that will allow us to efficiently and quickly get our content into the right formats. And you know, there's different ways of doing this. We'll talk a little bit today about what XML first means, and that in itself is a whole other session. But in this sense, what we have been trying to do here at Sage is to get the content far enough upstream to where it appears to be or is an XML first workflow, whatever adaptation you want to use of what XML first means. But in this slide that we have right here, the basics of it would say that on the journal side, we've adapted one basic XML standard. And then on the book side, we have adopted one standard schema type for the XML. And that's a very basic interpretation of it. And then from there, from that XML standard, we create the products, and that could go to typeset, that could be XML. And in the middle, what we have with the cute little diagram, it's a system that we call the Sage Online Content Repository. And that will take our XML, and that will move it and store the XML, validate the XML, and it will actually distribute it out. But importantly, it will also transform the content into different standards and formats that we need. So this is a very basic way of looking at kind of what we are trying to do with the content to allow us to more nimbly get our content into the different formats or places that we need it to go. So I'm going to go ahead here and just talk a little bit about the problems that we were seeing and why we had to go into this. And I think I won't read through each one of these, but essentially what we were looking at was we had a lot of different encoding requirements that we had to deal with. And certainly we had a lot of content, and the content needed to go into a lot of different places. And with that, we also had to store that content reliably. It wasn't as easy as getting a book and putting it on our shelf and hoping that we understood what to do with it at that point. We also knew that even if we had a standard XML type, that not everyone wanted to use that standard, and especially so on the book side. Book standards aren't quite there. They're still changing on a daily basis. Not everyone uses the same standard. And even if you use something like EPUB, you'll find that there are different versions of EPUB, and people will encode different ways. And so you have to be able to be nimble, and you have to be able to transform into different formats, and you have to be able to do that quickly and efficiently and, of course, cost-effective. And you need to be able to enrich content. So those are really some of the problems. Of course, there are many more. But the objectives of what we are trying to do in both an XML workflow, but also creating a repository to handle the content, store the content, and to transform the content, would be to, one, adopt some standard encoding practices. And then, two, of course, we needed to be able to secure that content once that we had it and know that we could then get at the content, transform the content when we needed to, and push it out to wherever it needed to go. An important piece to all this is enforcing the quality, the encoding quality and the content quality, conversion quality of that content that we have. And as I had mentioned, we have to be able to quickly and cheaply transform that content and get it out at a moment's notice. and then have a standardized platform to allow us to enrich the content or to analyze the content we have or discover so you can create different products from that point. So going back over to that slide that we were on and looking at this, the standards that we adopted were, of course, the journal side was a little more mature, but we adopted the JATS, previously known as the NLM DTD, for journals, and we opted to keep our journals DTD and our books DTD as a different process at this point, at least. I think it was fairly challenging to try to get even a standard for books, so we felt, you know, on the journal side, that was a fairly mature process, and we created that, worked with our typesetters, and took that process all the way up to the front end and started creating an XML workflow. Now, on journals, as I said, they're a little more mature, so it was easier. Most people accept the journals or the JADS DTD, and we didn't need to transform it that much. But even with that, we probably still transform that content to about 7 or 8 different variations and send it out to different partners. But on the book side, we had to come up with a standard. There wasn't really one available out there that we felt covered, one, all of the types of content that we had, and two, all the different types of platforms that were out there. EPUB wasn't rich enough for us to encode into, and the other standards that were out there weren't covering the basis of all of our content. So what we ended up doing is working to create one standard XML, what we call the XML hub schema, and that was based on an XHTML background. We create that content, or created that standard. It allows us to take in, encode everything into one standard, ingest it into our repository, and then transform it out to the different content formats that we need, whether that be EPUB, whether that be any one of the books DTD standards that are out there, or for a content app, or whatever it may be. But we have the nimble and easy ability to take it in through our repository, write a transformation, and send it out after that transform from the repository to wherever it needs to go. So in this interpretation, you see that we might have our own book products. We might send it to Apple. Of course, we send them to Amazon, and so forth and so on. So this is, again, a very basic interpretation of how we are doing what we do. But this process right here is allowing us to actually meet the business demands, and the business demands really were to get the content out quickly, effectively, cost-effectively, when and where they needed it, and whatever format it needed to be in. So I could go on for hours on these subjects, but of course I'd love to hear our other speakers and have them elaborate further on other tools and standards that they see and are using in the industry as well. And we can ask questions later, so please feel free to write in questions, and we'll go from there.
Thanks, John. Yes, that, if you have questions on John's presentation, you can submit them now, and we will we'll begin compiling them while the other speakers speak. And right now I'm going to hand things over to our next panelist. Please welcome Andrew Brenneman.
Thank you very much, Brian, and thank you, John. That was an excellent overview of some of the opportunities and challenges in cross-platform. I appreciate it. I'm president of Finitiv. Finitiv has, since 2008, been delivering to publishing organizations digital media consulting and technology services. Since the beginning of this year, our focus in both strategy and implementation has been around cloud-based production and product delivery solutions. And what I'd like to do is to talk about how cloud represents a new wrinkle on the cross-platform landscape. Let me take a step back and talk about essentially what was the first approach to supporting different platforms, and that is taking print assets and wrestling with them into ebook and other digital formats. This is often done with the involvement of service providers to do this conversion. What is convenient about this is that it does not affect any upstream processes. Manuscript creation, composition, and packaging occurs, as it always has, oriented toward the print output, and there are really no process changes or change required there. The disadvantage, of course, is that taking that print asset and putting it into something quite different, such as EPUB or NLM DTD, is at best a semi-manual process. There may be some tools involved to help with that, but it's slow. It's more expensive. And typically, it involves a certain amount of vendor dependence. It's very difficult for a publisher or content organization to really be in control of their entire process with Print First. Now, Print First sounds old, and aren't we all moved on to the kind of vision that John described? And the answer is no. This is the norm today. And the Print First model is something that certainly is holding the industry back. The second is, let's call it XML first. And I agree with John's use of that term, and that term may be applied to a wide variety of approaches. But essentially what we mean by that is there's some master manuscript in a format agnostic format. So it may be an XML, it may be a Word manuscript in DocX that can be converted to XML. And if it's properly structured and adheres to standards, DTDs, et cetera, then it can be submitted to automation processes to map that device agnostic content to the style sheet appropriate for an individual output. For example, pouring into an InDesign template for print, merging with a EPUB CSS for ebook, et cetera. It provides a high degree of automation and a lot of control for the publisher, control over the delivery time as well as cost. But there are some challenges there. First of all, the standards have to be defined up front in terms of understanding what are your encoding standards for that XML-based manuscript. And that is often a pretty in-depth process to do well. Second, there are changes to the publishing process, to the workflow, that are significant. If the XML-based manuscript is to be delivered into multiple formats, it must be final. Therefore, copy needs to be signed off before composition. This piece tends to be one of the biggest hurdles for publishing organizations because editors and authors are used to doing sometimes significant copy changes to galleys, and that breaks the model. So that often is a hurdle that is too high for publishing organizations, but those that do grapple and succeed in implementing those process changes are often able to achieve high levels of automation and control. And I think John outlined in a real-world situation basically what the promise is for this XML-first approach. But there is a third model that basically moves away from this notion of automation of production workflows, and that simply delivers content dynamically from the cloud. That content is maintained on a server, in this case represented by PCS Beacon, which is Finitiv's cloud delivery platform, and dynamically delivered into different devices, smartphones, tablets, cross OS, or web applications through a common interface. The formatting for each delivery device is done in real time, just the way a web content is styled with a CSS, which means it can remain in a format agnostic manner inside the cloud. In other words, you only have to create one format, load that into a cloud delivery system, and then the different delivery devices, be they web or mobile, can access that content and display it appropriately. In the case of PCS Beacon, the content that is loaded in is EPUB. And that EPUB file may be created through automated processes, or non-automated processes. However that EPUB is created can be loaded into the cloud and then dynamically delivered. So this is what we think is a third model that can be very compelling for publishers because it allows them to create one master format, load that, and then have web and mobile applications connect to that. The PCS Beacon is one of the products within Finitive's Cloud Suite. The other one that I wanted to mention, because it relates to the conversation today, is PCS Works, which essentially is a cloud-based automation platform for those publishing organizations who want to pursue an XML-first approach with automated conversion without necessarily creating their own infrastructure. So that is what we think of as the third way of cloud-based delivery. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Brian.
Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate the overview of cloud delivery. And as the questions tab in our back end here suggests, there's lots of people with lots of questions. So if you have questions, get them in now because it's filling up fast, and we're going to try to get to as many as we can. So without further ado, I'm going to now hand it over to Brian O'Leary. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, Brian. One of the things that I wanted to do is to try and step back a little bit and give the background about how we approach workflow changes. It very much is consistent with what you've heard from both Andrew and John this morning. But just to start, I'm just going to click through one diagram. Much of the work that we do with book, magazine, and association publishers involves structuring workflows that effectively allow them to meet current and emerging cross-platform expectations. In this case, I, when I talk about workflow, I define it as the intersection of process, which is how things get done, tools, which is not just technology, but any tools used to create, manage, and disseminate content, and people, which is the organizational structure, the roles people play, and the tools that they use. And in revising content workflows, which is fundamentally what you have to do to move from a print-based to a more agile approach, excuse me, it's seldom the case that a publisher can change things in just one area, like install a new CMS or move to a cloud-based approach, and not affect the other components. Sometimes the impact of a change is small. Other times it takes a pretty big change in an organization or a process to take full advantage of a new tool. And so conceptually, I think about it and I describe it as a set of three gears. The relative size of the gears in each case varies somewhat, so process might be smaller or larger in a given situation. But there's always an interdependence that if you don't address it, hamstrings a change that you make in trying to implement a new cross-platform workflow. The kinds of things that I ask clients when I go in, excuse me for having a frog in my throat this morning, the things that I ask clients about when I first start varies by each of these three areas. For example, when it comes to process, basic questions could include things like this. How do you typically create a book, a magazine, or a web page? What's the cycle times that you currently are using for creating basic content? You know, do you measure it in weeks, days, hours? Because that's going to have an effect on both the tools and the structure that you want to have in place. I also ask how well the current process is working. If you've got a pretty good system, you can build on it. But if you've got instances of error, rework, you're in an inability to meet schedules, or that a failure to meet current expectations, those things also have to be addressed before you can really implement a new or different workflow. And then, honestly, you want to look forward. You want to ask yourself, what changes and expectations do you anticipate in the next couple of years? When it comes to tools or technology, you do a basic inventory. What programs do you use to create, manage, and disseminate content? You see a lot of use of InDesign, some use of Quark. Word is not uncommon. In fact, Word XML has been used in a number of instances where we've worked with book publishers. We ask if there's a content management system in place and how long it's been and how well it's met expectations. We also try to find out if there are other systems in place. Digital asset management systems are one. Web content management would be another. And then we try to figure out how they're linked to the CMS. You've seen some really good diagrams from John and from Andrew about how it should work. But in a number of cases, they're kind of, some of these solutions are implemented without fully thinking through the linkages ahead of time. And that's a mistake. It's not an uncommon one, but it's one that needs to be addressed as you revise workflows. And then we look historically, you know, how the technology setup has changed in the last few years and how people on site think it needs to evolve. Finally, when it comes to the structure, organization, and people, we try to define how people are doing the content-related work now, how the roles have changed, at least recently, how much of the work is outsourced, because that's an important consideration as you try to think about populating content repositories, what the interaction is within an organization. You know, for example, if you're outsourcing to a company in the Philippines or India for content conversion, it's materially different from someone who's co-located in the publishing organization that you're in. And then sometimes we ask if there are organizations, particularly content producers, whose work a given client would like to emulate. There are a lot of good examples out there. You've seen a couple this morning, and I think that it's a useful way to start. But as you gather information about how work is currently done, you also get a sense of how deeply the staff has thought about workflow issues and how ready you might be to undertake a change. Before we turn back to questions, I actually have three posts that I've done. These are the short links, the bit.ly links for each of them, that are useful web resources for you. These are three gears and workflow conversations are kind of the underpinning of the presentation I've given this morning. But five guidelines is actually a link to five other posts that are specific to how I think about workflow redesign in content businesses. So if these are useful to you, that's great. It's a good way to feel to loop back as well as to look at this presentation again. And with that, I'll turn back to Brian.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brian. And now I'm going to turn things over to the Q&A portion of our presentation. And we've got a lot of questions, so I'm going to start moving through them now. First off, we have someone who says, this is all very new to me. Is there a concise something concise I can read to get more up to speed on cross-platform? Is there a primer, a short book, or an article any of you would recommend to someone who is trying to get up to speed and fast on this topic?
It's assigned to me, so I'll start. About 3 years ago, actually a little bit more than that, I co-wrote with Laura Dawson a research report for Riley Media called Start with XML. I think they took it off the market just earlier this year. It's about 3 years old. It holds up pretty well as a primer. I don't think it's going to give you enough information, for example, to implement a new system and the like. That's not really what its intent was. But it was one of the earliest looks at essentially an XML first or an XML early approach in book publishing. If it's no longer available for sale, I think they're selling it for $99. Feel free to contact me, and I'll pass along the copy that I have. I mean, if it's out of print or out of digital at any rate, I don't think there's a problem with that.
Great. How about Andrew or John? Any suggestions from you guys on this?
No, I would call Brian.
Okay.
And ask him what book I should read.
Yeah. You know, from my perspective, over the years, you always can go to your vendors as well that you use. Chances are your compositors actually understand the process well. They have a process. If you use conversion vendors, they certainly will most of the time be very open to helping you understand the landscape and then even looking at how you can start doing some of this in-house. And then otherwise, as Brian mentioned, there are a couple books out there. There are publishing blogs. And, of course, the different sessions like these will be very helpful to just pick up the information that you need.
I have one thing to add to John's point, and that is that publishers should be very aware of any conflicts of interest that might exist among the vendor. Some vendors' business models are based on integrating with a publisher workflow and fostering a dependence on using them for converting every title. So not all vendors will support publisher autonomy.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's something you have to acknowledge early on and understand how you want to proceed. And in some scenarios, at some publishers, that is perfectly okay, and people are okay handing it all over. In the case of Sage, we actually opted to do all of it ourselves, and we are independent. And I think there's some other questions that will allow me to follow up on this, but we chose to do most of this in-house and work with different people than to deploy some of the methods that we use.
Great.
And there was a follow-up question on this. How do we contact Brian? Do you want to give your
contact? I didn't think about that. My email is Brian, B-R-I-A-N, O'Leary, at MagellanMediaPartners.com. Or if you just Google Brian O'Leary, I show up in a lot of different places.
Great. So let's move on to another question. We'll do one for John. Someone, and this is something that I know Andrew will have something to say about as well, given that he wrote an article about this for the book business earlier in the year. The question is, I work in book and reference, and we are in the middle of setting up a similar process to what John was discussing. I would be interested in learning more about XML content and variations. We currently use what our IT folks refer to as Microsoft Word XML, not true XML. Do you have any suggestions?
You know, the first thing there that scares me a little bit is that thing called Microsoft Word XML. I think there are opportunities to use Microsoft Word to get your XML, but of course, if you use that save as XML in Microsoft Word, that is a no-no. You will not come out with a quality piece of XML, and if you open that XML up, you'll have a better understanding of what I mean by that. They do embed a lot of their own tags and codes there. As far as getting in and creating that workflow and looking at different types of workflows and content variations, what we had done over the years, and it was a luxury that we had, but it's how we went forward, is that we did use and liaise with a good amount of XML consultants in the industry that were in the know of standards that were coming up and standards that had been in the past, people that had understood typesetting and different workflows at different publishers. So it allowed us to get a good understanding of what was out there, what they had seen, what the opportunities were, and then that allowed us to then create the process that worked for our company. There are many ways that you can go at this. So there's unfortunately not one way we could say, take this path or take this path. So, I would say that the people that we have here on the phone today are all good sources of information to allow you to understand how you might create that workflow.
Yeah, I'd like to address that as well. Microsoft Word it does contain XML. The question is it good XML? Well, not in the truest sense. A docx file is a zip file that contains XML data in it. What Finitiv has done in its technology solutions is to take that docx file, and if the publisher uses a standard set of styles, we're able to extract from that docx XML, clean it up, put it into a true XML format, and then perform automation on that. You need the software development in order to do that, and what works is essentially a software platform for doing that XML extraction from Microsoft Word. If anybody's interested in having Microsoft Word be their device agnostic format, drop me a line at andrew@finitiv.com.
Okay. We have several questions for Andrew that he said he'd like to answer regarding the cloud system. And so let me hand it over to Andrew.
Sure.
to talk about some of those.
Yeah, and I covered a lot in a short period of time, and there's a couple of questions that I'd like to address so people have an understanding of this model, particularly using a PCS beacon. The ingest format is EPUB, so PCS Beacon will take in any EPUB as it exists. PCS Beacon then essentially interprets the EPUB, extracts the data elements, maintains it in a truly device-independent format, and then makes it available for digital delivery applications on the web and mobile. That's the primary focus. It is not a pre-press system. It is a system for dynamically delivering to digital applications. Essentially, because the EPUB format is standards compliant, it's not strictly text only. Whatever's in there in terms of formatting described in the CSS in the EPUB is maintained or can be maintained, as well as images extracted and represented. So we are going down the road of using EPUB as a standard container, as an API endpoint, if you will, and writing wherever HTML and EPUB 3 go. In terms of what you deliver this on, how do you deliver this content, do you need a reading app? Well, let me put it this way. You need client software to deliver that content. If you want to deliver that content in a format like EPUB, yes, you'll need a software component that has a reader. We deliver solutions using Monocle's Reader, which is an open source project to create web-based e-reading experiences, but there's a range out there that you can use. Now, you might not want necessarily to deliver that content in a format in the standard EPUB metaphor. You might want it to make it look more web-like, and you're able to do that, again, with the client software. One point that's really key that I wanted to point out, and this isn't related to Beacon per se, but one point I made about copy edits and composition, in the XML first, you need to have final copy before you pour it into InDesign so that it can go into InDesign and EPUB and all the various formats that you want to deliver. If during composition, say you're using InDesign, you do make copy edits, then you've got a challenge because you've got to figure out how to get those copy edits back upstream into your XML manuscript. So that's the challenge there. So the preferred method is to get that signed off before you bring it into the InDesign environment. And I guess those are the main batch that I wanted to talk about. In terms of print, for cross-platform, if you are doing automation from the XML first, you would take your XML manuscript and you would create a file that you could then put into an InDesign template to support prepress.
Okay.
Okay, Brian, thanks.
Sure. So next question is for John. During your presentation, you mentioned that when you were addressing standards for Sage, that EPUB you found to be not rich enough for you. Can you share your thoughts on EPUB 3, which has HTML5, CSS3, and Java capabilities? Have you looked into that?
Right. So the standard that we use is actually a base of XHTML, so it will support EPUB 3 and hopefully all future editions of that, wherever it transforms to. Of course, we'll have to update that as we go. But to go back to the statement that I made of not being rich enough, so with Sage, if all we were doing was creating an EPUB and trying to get it online for an app or a HTML5 presence, then that would be fine. But in our case, we're developing content platforms with very rich features, and we have to encode the XML at a much deeper level. And although EPUB 3 goes a far way to encoding at a more granular level, it's still not getting at the sets or the detail of encoding of all the elements that we need to run the feature sets on our platforms. And so we are custom designing platforms to do certain things. So in the scenario that we looked at, we had to look at where's the content going, what do we think we might be doing with it, how do we need to encode it, and then at that point we went upstream to create the actual schema that would support all the different variations that we needed. And that's why I say the transform is so important. So we couldn't just go to EPUB and then hope that was going to work for something. We needed to go upstream even further, create something that was even more rich than that, and then we transformed down to each one of the formats that we do need. So hopefully that answers the question okay.
Yeah, great. This is Brian on this. I mean, I absolutely agree with John's take on it. The EPUB two or three, it doesn't really matter, is an effective package or container, but it's not a DTD. It's not a way to essentially describe content so that it can be used and reused in a variety of different ways. It's a reasonable input, as Andrew described, it's a reasonable input for the process that he has in the cloud because you understand it, but it's not particularly flexible. And if you have to, when you're developing a use case for the work that you're going to be doing, if you have to use your content in a variety of different ways, you want to make sure that it's as flexible as it can be at the origin, not kind of constricted as it would be under a format like EPUB.
Okay, and the next question I've assigned to you, Brian, but anyone can jump in on this as well. For a nonprofit with few resources which wants to keep up with expanding delivery platforms, but one that can't afford to do it themselves, what is the best option? What would be the best way to jump into this?
Well, I think that actually it would build a little bit on the answer I just gave, which is the first question I would ask any client, but particularly one with limited resources, is what's important to get done? I mean, you don't want to just create an XML or an Agile content repository if you're not going to have an opportunity to use and reuse the content in a variety of different ways. So if ultimately you can't define what it is that you're going to do with it, I would say, step back and kind of create things that reflect the efficiencies that you have. But beyond that, I mean, if you do want to be effective, but you can't afford to build a repository, there are an increasing number of alternatives for vendors that will manage this on a relatively inexpensive basis. You don't have to build the systems yourselves. It may affect you sometimes on cycle time, or it probably would require you to change some aspect of how you're organized or where your content gets stored and the like. But you can at least take advantage of those and sort of pay on an as-you-go basis rather than on an upfront fixed cost basis for developing and implementing systems.
Yeah, I'd like to address that. We work with many nonprofits, both grant-based content organizations and university presses, and a lot of the impetus of creating a low-cost cloud-based utility was to fit into financial scenarios like this. A cloud platform already exists. You don't have to build it. There may be some customization involved, but you don't have to buy hardware or software or hire operations people to keep it going. So I think cloud is the way that you get access to these systems without building it.
John, you first.
I was going to make a simple, or it's kind of a question and an answer. It really comes down to what is it that you need to do. And for instance, if the business that you're trying to get in is we need to sell this book on Amazon, you can work directly with someone like Amazon to do that. And of course, it's not the most effective long-term solution, but there are ways you can quickly get in, work with the partner that you need to work with, and they'll take their own percentages or cuts of the revenue, by helping you go through that process, but they'll also make sure that your content gets online. So I think the most important thing was asking that first question: what is it you need to accomplish, and then from there create that solution that would work best.
Yeah, the other piece of advice I give is when you're using an outside service or a cloud-based service, try to customize it as little as possible. Change yourselves mm-hmm. and take advantage of what is probably best practice in what they do. Before you try to change what they do, it'll save you time and money, and it also right. makes sure that you can always take advantage of the most recent versions of the software.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think we have time for one more quick question, and this one's for John. The question is, do you use composition vendors, and if so, how did you bring them up to speed on your XML code and maintain your quality?
Yeah, it's a really good question. We do use composition vendors, and a couple of years from now, I may say that we don't because we develop tools and no longer need them. But at this point, with the variation of what we have, we do have a few vendors. In the process of creating all of our workflows, we actually once had probably over 20 different vendors across our companies. A few in each one of the areas that we published or publishing offices at Sage. So we consolidated those down to two because we really needed to get at standards, and we needed to hold them more accountable to running the workflow that we needed. So we picked two vendors that we had been using for a long time. They are both Indian-based vendors. they're on the smaller side. They're not the bigger ones that are out there. And we actually, once we developed the standards that we needed to use, we developed training guidelines, specifications on how to use our XML. We created XSLT transforms and XQueries to sit there and to hand over to them so they could actually create the XML, validate the XML themselves, and then hand it over to us at a high quality. That process didn't come easy, it didn't come cheap, and it did take a long time, and we still are in the middle of it with some of the book content that we're working on. As I said earlier, journals are a lot easier, but when you get into books, and if you have a lot of variation on templates and process or types of books that you use or publish, that can become a little more challenging.
Thanks so much, John. I think we need to wrap things up now. Any questions we didn't get to will be provided to our panelists, and if they're able to follow up after the show, they will have that opportunity. I want to thank you all again for speaking, and I want to thank everyone out there for attending. On behalf of Book Business, I want to thank you all for attending this session. If you're interested in discussing anything that you heard during this presentation, we encourage you to visit the Networking Lounge to chat live with other session attendees. You can also visit the info booth to fill out our show survey and let us know about your experience today, which I hope was excellent. Please also check out the agenda for the rest of the day. If this session interested you, you'll definitely want to check out our 2 o'clock session, Organizations Confronting Digital Change, where we'll have case studies from Human Kinetics and the Harvard Business Review Press. We have a full agenda of other sessions lined up and encourage you to view as many as you can. Remember, if you can't watch them live today, add them to your briefcase and view at your convenience in the on-demand environment. Have a great show, everyone.